This week's episode of the Worn and Whelmed podcast is brought to you by the Wind Up Watch Shop. In the Wind Up Watch Shop, you'll find an array of exciting, innovating brands offering watches that appeal to a wide variety of tastes and styles. From quartz watches with impeccable design and detailing, to one-of-a-kind mechanical timepieces with tech unlike anything you've ever seen before, the Wind Up Watch Shop has something for everyone. So head over to www.windupwatchshop.com. That's www.windupwatchshop.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the Worn and Whelmed podcast. On this week's episode, Zach sits down with Nicholas Bowman Scargill, the managing director of Fears Watches. So let's get a little bit of background before we jump into the conversation. Fears was founded in 1846 by a young watchmaker named Edwin Fear, who set up his workshop and showroom in Bristol. It was a family-run business for the entirety of its operation, and it ran until 1976 when the company closed its doors. Then, in 2016, Nicholas, who is the great-great-great-grandson of Edwin Fear, brought the company back, releasing its first watch in 40 years, the Redcliffe. Zach met Nicholas at the wind-up reception hosted by Watches of Switzerland in Soho late last year. The two got to talking, and that's when Zach realized it would be great to get Nicholas on the podcast to tell the story of Fears. Nicholas swung by Worn & Wound HQ late last year, and this episode was actually recorded on the third anniversary of the brand's relaunch. Nicholas and Zach cover a wide range of topics. They discuss the brand's history, its revival, the importance of heritage and authenticity, and what Nicholas thinks the future holds in store for Fears. If there's something that you want us to cover in a future episode of the Worn & Wound podcast, then hit us up at info@worn-and-wound.com. Without further ado, here is Zach and Nicholas Bowman Scargill.
Hello everyone, this is Zach Weiss, and today I am joined by Nicholas Bowman Scargill, the fourth managing director of Fears Watches from London, correct? Or did I get that wrong? You're from the UK, but you might not be from London.
Well, originally I was from London, but okay. I'm now based down in Canterbury,
okay,
down in southeast England.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this is quite fortuitous because we actually just met about a week ago.
Yes.
At the after party on the first day of Wind Up. You were there, and I actually noticed your watch, and then I noticed the watch of the gentleman you're with, and I was like, I bet they're from Fears Watches. And I, you know, it's a brand I've been aware of, but frankly, had a lot to know. So getting to talk to you a bit there was really exciting, because I feel like I very quickly got a kind of crash course in what Fears Watches is about, the history, and it's really a fascinating story. So hopefully we can get into it all today. So usually when we start the podcast, we just do a what's on your wrist sort of moment, like a what are you wearing? There's only two of us, so why don't you start? What watch are you wearing?
So I'm wearing my personal Fears Brunswick.
Okay.
So it's a watch which we brought out 2 years ago exactly, and it's my own personal one. So It's the one I've worn for all different occasions, and it has serial number 13.
Number 13.
I was born on Friday the 13th.
Okay.
So 13 is my lucky number,
right.
And I thought, no one wants to own watch number 13.
Right.
That watch is always going to come back with some issue, isn't it?
Perfect. So you don't do number one, you do number 13. That's your
number person. 13, yeah. All someone right. else has number one.
Okay. Very cool. So I'm also wearing a British watch, so to speak, the Farrer Markham World Timer, one of their newest releases. I'm in the process of writing a review of it, so hence why I'm wearing it today. But it's quite a nice watch, and I figured the British connection wasn't a bad idea either. So, you know, it sounded like you had a really interesting origin story sort of for this brand, because the brand is actually quite old.
Correct? Yes, it's 173 years old. Mm-hmm. It's founded in 1846. It's one of Britain's oldest watch companies.
And I imagine, you know, back in the 1840s, you know, what exactly were they making? Was it pocket watches, kind of classic handmade style of watchmaking?
Yeah. Yes, it was, you know, those very early Victorian style silver case pocket watches, The ones where you sort of open the back, wind it with a key, then you open the glass and adjust the hands with the same key, you know, no stem winding or adjustment. And we're lucky to actually have in the archive a watch that my great-great-great-grandfather, Edwin Fear, made himself, and he signed the movement. And it's just a beautifully produced pocket watch in a silver case. So it wasn't a gold sort of fancy watch. It was just a good, nice, everyday pocket watch. Right. And that's what they did for decades at the beginning.
So you actually just there touched on something very interesting, which is that this is a brand that has been in your family for generations. So could you get actually into your history in the world of watchmaking and then how you came to revive Fierce?
Yeah, it's almost like there's two stories running there. So the one is the story of the company. So Fierce was founded in 1846 in Bristol in the west of England, and it ran for 130 years until 1976. And when it closed, it was when the third managing director retired. He was my great-grandfather. And then the business skipped 40 years. It was dormant, something we highlight a lot. We don't try and gloss over those 40 years because they also, that's a lot of not only watch brand history, but also history of businesses in Britain. A lot of businesses, family businesses, were closing in the 60s and 70s. And then 3 years ago today, I restarted the company.
Today
is the third birthday of the relaunch of Fierce.
Oh, wow. That's a happy birthday to Fierce. I actually did not know that. That's excellent.
Yeah, if we go back to that sort of 3 years ago when I restarted the company, my background's slightly unusual. So I did my degree is in economics. I was going to become an investment banker. I did an internship with Deutsche Bank, and that's what I was going to do. But I graduated in the summer of 2008. So just as the entire financial world that I'd been sort of trained to aspire to blew up in my face, and I wasn't bright enough to hold on to my job prospects. So I sort of scrambled around for a new job, and I ended up working in consumer PR. So I worked for an agency in London. We did things like worked for people like Hewlett-Packard, Gillette Razors, but also our most interesting client was the Royal Mint, who make all the currency for the UK.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I know a ridiculous amount about what goes into making a coin and how it's like stamped and all that.
Interesting.
I think that kind of appeals to the inner geek in me. Like, I love that sort of technical knowledge. But while I was doing that, I enjoyed the work, but I'm dyslexic, and writing press releases and doing sort of lots of emails, it's just not really me. And I sort of, around 2010, I sat down and said, right, if I could do anything in the world, what would it be? Because it wasn't going to be banking. That obviously wasn't meant to happen. PR's okay, but it's not exactly me. What would I be? And since I was a kid, I've had two passions. One of them is watches, and one of them is trains.
Okay.
So I investigated becoming either a watchmaker or a train driver.
Really?
Which I think over here is a train engineer.
Or conductor. Interesting.
And so I looked into both of those jobs and sort of researched it, what the work would require. And as much as I love trains, I didn't like the idea of all the shift work and having to move around the country, whereas watchmaking really appealed to me. So
very different ends of the spectrum.
Right.
Kind of, you know, very small scale versus massive scale. But I guess you have complex machinery in both.
Yeah, they're both to do with sort of engineering and process as well. You know, when you're driving a train, it's not like driving a car. Like, you have to stick to timetables and rules and regulations.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
when you're repairing a watch, you have to do the same. It's not, it's creative, but not in a full creative artistic way.
Yeah, yeah.
So I decided on watchmaking and started looking at all the big Swiss firms who had service centers in the UK. And I wrote a 2-page covering letter off to them explaining why consumer PR to watchmaking was a natural career progression.
Okay.
And after 7 months of interviews and practical assessments, Rolex eventually gave in and said, fine, we'll take you on as an apprentice in London. And that was back in 2011.
Okay.
And it was an incredible job.
I mean,
working for Rolex, and not for an AD, but working for the company itself is absolutely incredible. It's a very humble company, and it's also inspiring, you know.
Right.
Everyone is very aware that they work for this special place and doing a special job. But after a few years of working there, you realize that as a watchmaker, the next 40 years you're going to be sat at the same bench doing the same job. And I was like, actually, I've always had, not necessarily like an entrepreneurial bug, but I've always wanted to maybe do my own thing. So this is where the story gets very strange. I was back home with my parents one Sunday, just having Sunday lunch. And I said this to them. I said, oh, I'd love to do my own thing one day, but I don't even know what industry I'd do it. And my mum, sort of jokingly, as she's serving up the roast potatoes, goes, why don't you restart the family watch company?
Yeah.
And it, I mean, an absolute eureka light bulb moment of going, what?
What family watch company?
Now, when I was applying to Rolex, she had said, oh, you know, you have relatives who were watchmakers. So it's obviously in your blood, you know, your great grandfather and his father, they were watchmakers and they did all their training out in Glashütte.
Okay.
So that's the big thing Fears used to do. They'd send watchmakers out to do training there and then bring them back to Bristol. But I assumed they were like a sort of one-man band, you know, doing local repairs, not also being managing directors of the West of England's largest watchmaker.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, at that point, that was back in 2014. And it was like, right, this has to be done. This is now what I'm going to dedicate my life to.
Yeah. They weren't also going to tell you, like, we also had a train manufacturer, but like...
I know, right? And be like, oh my goodness, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you can't make that up. I mean, that's an excellent origin story and a very cool way to get back into it. So then Fears Watches, 1840s, origin, 70 years. What would you say like was the height of the company? What did they have? Like, what was their production kind of at a max point, you know?
Well, before the Second World War, they were employing around 100 watchmakers in Bristol. Wow. So they were, you know, obviously everyone's heard of Smiths from Britain. Well, Fears was founded 5 years before Smiths and ran till 5 years after Smiths. Wow. And for the West of England, Fears was bigger and Fears did much more international. Mm. So certainly after the Second World War, Fears was exporting to 95 countries around the world. And even today, we'll get contacted by people all around the world, you know, from US, Canada, India, out in Dubai, Australia, who have Fears watches.
Very cool.
That, you know, their relatives had owned. So, you know, they were making hundreds of thousands of watches. And it's very interesting because you can tell if a watch was made to be sold domestically or internationally. Mm. The domestic watches just said Fears.
Okay.
The international one said Fears, Bristol, England.
Oh, interesting.
And it's just quite, and this is also interesting. After the Second World War, we found that there were a lot of watches sold in Britain with international export dials.
Okay.
Of course, realizing that you'd had 6 years where they weren't able to be exporting these watches.
Right.
Because, you know, they weren't, you know, there was conflict. So it's quite interesting to see how many bits of the Fears story are linked to just what was going on in Britain at the time.
Yeah.
You know, we've got recently donated to the archive the last ever brochure from 1975. And in the front cover of the brochure, it says, you know, prices, you know, due to the current inflation of prices, you know, please call for the latest price list because by the time we print it, it will be out of date.
Right.
Well, the mid 70s in the UK, the inflation rate was rampant. It was a hyperinflation period.
Okay.
And so it's fascinating to see that in a practical document, like saying call us because by the time we write it down, it will be out of date.
Yeah. Wow. And so in that catalog, I mean, what's the style of the watches? Is it what you come to kind of expect of the period, or did Fears have its like something specific?
Very much sort of the period. So, I mean, you see the watches from the 70s and you know, you've got these wonderful shaped cases, you know, that, and also the dials, they're very sort of, well, very much of the quartz is coming, quartz is here. We need to do something that is eye-catching, different. You go back to the 60s and things are sort of looking quite modern. You go to the 50s and it's that classic, elegant, sort of understated look. Personally, I prefer the watches from the 40s.
Okay.
So in 1946, Fears celebrated its 100th anniversary and it celebrated that with a centenary collection. And the watches from that collection were just so elegant. Mm-hmm. They were just, you know, these were very much made to be your one watch for life. Yeah. So they were kind of very timeless. And for me, that's very inspiring. You know, those very clean lines. You know, Fears didn't do tool watches. Mm-hmm. They didn't do what I'd call like sort of dress watches in, you know, solid golds and platinums. What they did were they specialized in doing good everyday watches.
Yeah.
That sort of old category that nowadays everything has to be sort of either a dress or tool.
And the subgenres kill me. And I'm very much guilty of building that, you know, through our site and kind of helping categorize things. But I'm writing something and I'm like, does this fit into this category or is it a tool watch or like, you know, and then I'm just kind of like, why can't it just be... It's just like a casual watch or,
it's just a business.
Yeah, you know, it's just a watch. Yeah. But I can picture though what you're saying. it's purposeful. It's back when people had one watch, you know, that watch had to serve the most common purpose, which was telling time through the day when you're at your desk. It wasn't for jumping off of cliffs in the Maldives. I don't know if that's something you do there, but you know what
yeah,
I mean?
It's like, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, and the idea is these were the watches worn, not necessarily by like the CEO of the company or the chairman. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were being worn by like the managers, you know. And when you convert the pricing into modern money, they're very much, they were several months' wage. So they weren't a cheap watch, but they weren't sort of like the Rolls Royce where you have to have, you know, this was going to be a year's salary, you know. Mm-hmm. So kind of pricing it in that sort of, that sort of pricing. But it's very interesting as we've, you know, build the archive up and we now have a division of the company where we restore and service old Fears watches, the oldest of which is from the 1860s.
Yeah.
And we had to make components for that watch from scratch.
I bet.
But what's fascinating is going through them and looking, especially at the movements. So by the 40s, 50s, 60s, these movements are sort of what, they were basically the good, high quality movements available out there. So they weren't necessarily Fears movements, but you know, in one of our watches, one model line, suddenly finding the movements were actually made by IWC. And then another one, it was SA, another one, it's ETA. Mm-hmm. Chronographs had Minerva movements.
Oh, wow.
You know, so.
Oh, those must be exceptional. Yeah.
You know, but the thing was, they were, you know, good, rock solid movements, you know, in good cases, nice dials, good quality hands.
So they're sourcing, they weren't sourcing the cheapest or whatever, they're sourcing quality over. Yeah.
And I think that's the thing when you look at the watches and the old archive adverts and things, you know, they're elegant, clean designs. There was nothing sort of. I wouldn't say striking, you know, it wasn't like they were sort of wacky designs or they were just made to be good workhorses. Almost like, I always describe it like a 1990s Mercedes-Benz.
Okay.
You know, it's sort of boxy, it's clean lines, but bulletproof, you know, it's built just to keep going and going.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the like landscape in the UK, where did they position themselves?
So they were, as well as having a large export side, they were predominantly over in the west of England. They were sold through different retailers as well as the Fears' own stores.
They had retail.
Yeah, they had their own retail.
It's amazing, sold. Like, I mean, the scale of some of these companies that fell apart in this, you know, usually in the end of the 20th century, towards the end of the 20th century, and then like that history just sweeps them away, sort of. It's remarkable. Yeah.
This is the thing. In the UK, you'll be talking to watch collectors or people, or even going to Bristol and talking to people, and they'll go, hang on, why have I not heard of Fears? You say, well, 40 years is sort of, it's two generations. It's enough time to fall out of the public's consciousness. And also, you know, back in the 70s, watch companies, watch brands, they weren't sort of spoken about in the way that they are today. You know, today, if a company just stopped and disappeared, there would be chatter about it. There would always be a permanent record online or written in public, you know, this is now gone and this. Whereas back then, it was just one of many British businesses closing its doors. And I think that's, it's interesting with the retail presence because in Bristol, where their headquarters were, where their main sort of flagship shop was, it was on a corner by Bristol Bridge and Redcliffe Street. And that corner became known locally as Fears Corner.
Wow.
And so, you know, the Bristol archives have records from people's diaries at the time saying, oh, I went and met my friend for a coffee and we met at Fears Corner and then went to Lyons Tea Rooms. Right. It was sort of known in Bristol as Fears Corner. Even after the premises had been completely bombed and destroyed, it was still, everyone knew that corner on that street was Fears' Corner.
That's very cool.
Yeah, it's bizarre. There's now an office space there with sort of co-working. And we've actually started working with a company who are based in that office.
Okay.
And it's very weird because all these surrounding buildings are intact. So when you're in their office looking out of the window on the third floor, it's the exact view that the watchmakers would have had back in the 30s. And that's really quite eerie. It's I love that.
No, totally. Okay, so you find out there's a family brand, Fears Watches, and where do you go from there? How do you relaunch?
Well, the first thing is what most people would do. You open up a Google search window and go, how to start a watch company.
Okay.
I mean, literally as basic as that.
Yeah.
And I think if you go back to 2014, yes, there were some micro brands. Mm-hmm. There were some independent brands being established, but there wasn't a lot of information out there. There wasn't a lot of chatter. There was the odd forum post about, oh, will these companies in Switzerland do this? And so what the first thing I did was head out to Baselworld 2015. And I was still working with Rolex at the time. So I was there sort of as a, not representing Rolex. I was there on my own time, but it was still kind of having to do this on the quiet, you know, on the side. And just went and started talking to manufacturers in Switzerland at the show, and also meeting other watch brand owners and start talking to them and being like, hey, you probably don't want to help me, but could you? And, you know, I met some incredible people who today I still speak to on a regular basis. And I'm very grateful for the sort of the advice and the time, because as I think increasingly a lot of people are aware, there's very different ways of making watches. And at first you think, oh, well, I'll do it this way. And then you go, actually, I want to do it that way. And being a self-funded business, you know, I kind of was beginning to work out, like, how much did I need to start the business with? Which is why I ended up selling my watch collection. Pretty much anything wasn't screwed down in our house got put on eBay. You know, it was stopped going on foreign holidays, stopped eating out. You know, it's all those things you do to build up a, you know, a chunk of money to then start with. But
the bootstrapping.
Exactly.
Very familiar.
Yeah. But it's also, it's on reflection, vitally important, because it means you get to decide the tone of things, how things, I mean, there's loads of things we did in the very first days where any investor or anyone would have gone, that's a waste of money. Why would you do that? And these are some of the things we've become quite well known for. And they very much set the tone of like how the business is.
What's an example of that?
So things like when we launched, we launched with a lithographed brochure. So I did a night course at City University in London to learn Adobe Illustrator and InDesign. So I do my own technical drawings. I design the watches, but I also do a lot of the graphics work for the business. I just want to kind of control freak, want to make sure everything matches, all the Pantones match and everything's right. And I was adamant that I wanted to launch with a beautifully produced 26-page brochure, a physical A5 brochure. And from the off said, right, we will send these out free to anyone in the world. And that's something we still do today. What's fascinating is to realize, I mentioned the brochure from 1975 that got donated to the archive. So on the front of it, it had a number, and that was brochure number 436.
Okay.
So in 130 years, Fears had produced 436 issues of the Fears international catalog.
Oh, wow.
But for me, I was like, this is important because I'm a believer
part of the
that
DNA of the brand.
But it's also, if you, yes, you could download a PDF, but come on, most people want to pick up and hold something and, you know, and buying a watch isn't a, for some people, it's a, you know, I see it, I like it, I buy it. It's all done very quickly. For a lot of people, it is a considered purchase. And actually, a brochure that sits on your coffee table or your bedside table, you know, you come back to it, you fold the corners, you rip out a page. You know, I was adamant that we should be doing that. But of course, that's very expensive. And even today, it's expensive posting these brochures out. But it's something that I feel, maybe it's because of the heritage. But I also am a fan of using the best of modern technology, you know, Instagram, website, you know, email, all these things. But also using some of the old-fashioned ways of doing business. You know, every watch comes with a signed letter. You know, we send these brochures out. That's a physical thing. But sometimes you don't want to kind of throw away the old traditional ways because some of them are actually better. It's kind of finding that mix between the two.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like given the unique history of your brand and that there was a history of brochures, like it's sort of putting, like sticking, it's not inauthentic. Like I think there are brands that might do that to create the sensation of an old thing or to kind of the illusion of it. And it might, not to insult anyone who does it, because it might work and it might have the right intentions behind it, but like you're continuing something. So, you know, I can understand that. But yes, I also understand the like, could your money have been spent elsewhere at that initial?
You know? Oh, absolutely. I mean, my goodness, likely, if I think back all the things over the last, you know, so many years that you've spent money on, you on reflection, you're like, why did I do that? But, you know, I've not run a watch company before. You know, it's not like, you know, I've got a generation above me, my father or my mother saying, oh, this is how you should be doing it. Like, no, you know, it's, but yeah, so I started off with Googling, going to Switzerland, finding different manufacturing partners. I was very adamant that I wanted a lot of control over the design of things, but also I was very adamant that I didn't want to just recreate the old vintage watches.
Okay.
I'm not saying it would be easy, but it would be quite an obvious thing to do and go. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I still say, if you like a look of a vintage Fears watch, go on eBay, have a look for one. You know, what I want to create is what would the company be doing today in 2019 if it had kept on going?
Okay. And how do you determine that?
Well, you look through what it used to do, and you've got the basics of these very sort of elegant watches that were watches, not dress, not tool, how they were made. But also you look at things like for 20 years, they used a certain shape of hand. Mm-hmm. So we use that hand today and we call that shape the Fears hand. It's like a syringe, but it's not a syringe hand.
You know, you have a lapel pin.
Yeah, it's that shape.
That shape.
Yeah. So that the logo of the company, the Fears Pipette, that only became a logo after we'd launched and people kept saying, oh, that shape is very distinctive. It's very Fears.
Okay.
And it then subsequently became the logo of the company. But the Fears typeface on the dial, that was used for 30 years by the company. You know, there's certain elements in some of the typography, some of the proportions. So it's going, right, well, these were clearly things that were important. They weren't like a sort of, oh, this year everyone's doing this.
Right.
These were things they had in their DNA. So you carry those forward, but you update, you know, different case sizes. Still, you know, relatively small, but, you know, you also... Production now allows you to do many more curves, many more radiuses on the watch, you know, different dial finishes, colors, you know, bringing in, I would say, things that are more, we're able to do in the 21st century, but also more, I don't know, more desirable in the 21st century.
Okay.
So yeah, that was a key thing. And so it was finding the manufacturing partner. Now we started originally doing Swiss made. Mm-hmm. So we had our watches made in Switzerland, then shipped to the UK. And then 2 years ago, when we launched our first mechanical, the Brunswick, that was the start of the change. So we now hand build all our watches in the UK.
All right.
Now, we're not made in Britain because, you know, we're not doing anything like Roger Smith, you know.
Yeah.
He is hand making these watches, right? So what we're doing is hand building. So we do a lot of finishing of components. We do make our watch hands in-house. Okay. It take a day to make one set of hands, but components like dials, cases, we have those made in Germany. Mm-hmm. Movements come from Switzerland, straps come from Belgium, but we use our own leather, which is made in Bristol.
Okay.
So it's sort of using the best manufacturers out there. And the great thing of when you're in Britain is for me to go and visit the dial manufacturer, it's an hour and 15 minutes on a plane, 20 minutes in a taxi. And you're there. So when we want to pick a specific shade of blue or a specific color of a typeface or, you know, a finishing on the dial, you can just jump on a plane and go and have a 3-hour meeting to determine that one tiny little thing.
Yeah.
And for me, that's vitally important. Also, almost every single supplier we work with is family run. Mm. And that's really important to me because there is that when you're sat down, and they're like, oh, I'm the third generation and I'm the sixth generation. And you kind of feel that connection. And often for these guys, I am by far their smallest watch brand that they work with.
Yeah.
But because there is that sort of family run business element to it, they're like, no, we'll work with you. Yeah. You know, we like what you're doing. You know, it's sort of in tune with how we like to do things. So for me, that's really important about how the business is run. It's not just going, oh, well, these guys are cheaper. I'm not interested in cheaper.
Yeah.
I'm interested in finding the experts, finding the people who you can spend 1 hour talking about exactly what angle the bevel on a sunken subseconds on a dial, which is going to have lacquer flown onto it. You know, for me, that's exciting. That's the inner geek in me is getting excited about that. And then with people like our leather straps. So I know we were chatting a bit about the straps at Windup. So the leather we use is from Britain's oldest vegetable tanners. So that's a nice thing on the side. They also make all of the leather for the world's cricket balls.
Okay.
Which is cool. Cool little fact. They also used to work with Fears in the 1920s.
Even better. Yeah.
And I came across them from an article in the Financial Times. And so I called them up and I said, this is very strange. Your heritage and history is in Bristol. So is my company's, like, you know. And so I said, and they said, what's the name of your brand? And I said, Fears. And they're like, yeah, we worked with you. So it's amazing to be walking around the tannery and being like, yeah, actually, 90 years ago, my forebearers were probably doing the same thing. Yeah. Well, actually, the company was bigger then, so they probably had someone else to walk around the tannery.
Right, fair enough.
But you know, for me, it's very important to get excited about these little details.
Were you able to like trace down the like articles of leather, or like did they still make that same leather, that kind of stuff, or was it
sadly not? No, okay. No, that had changed. The process they make the leather in is identical.
Yeah, vegetarian leather is ancient technology.
It's exactly, and cool, all the leather they're using is like a waste product of the of the beef industry in the UK. So it's, and being vegetable tanned, it's kind of this thing where actually you come forward to today, it's got a nice element of sustainability about it. It's, you know, but it's nice that they create, so we have this special blue we call Fierce Blue, and we spent months developing that color with them.
Okay.
So they tan it just for us.
Okay.
So yeah, these are the things I take great pride in how we should do it.
We work with a tannery called Wicked and Craig, which is very similar sounding. I mean, it's a veg tan exclusive tannery, and they're one of the oldest in the US, though I think they weren't continually operational. Same thing, their leathers all come from after, you know, the beef market. I think they actually are owned by something in the food market. So they
right,
you know, it's all like the chain is all there, kind of the supply chain comes directly from that. But, you know, I remember visiting it a couple of years ago because we were sourcing leather. We're looking for like the hardiest leather to line our straps with, and that's what we end up with. So all the Warner One straps that have like tan or black leathers is veg tan leather from there. And one of the things they hold with great pride there is that the water that leaves the factory is cleaner than the water that comes in. And it was just like, that is such a wonderful, you know, because it's, you know, classically tanning, especially chromium tanning, and all, it's actually very poisonous and has left a lot of parts of the world with, what do you call it, like Superfund sites, essentially.
Yeah,
you know, they had to clean up, you know, 100 years later because people weren't paying attention a long time ago to this kind of stuff. So,
well, there's a big thing at the moment with, you know, so many different industries talking about sustainability.
Yeah.
And Fizz is 173 years old. If the business is going to be running in 173 years' time, then, you know, what kind of world is that going to be, and what's our impact on that? And naturally, watches aren't necessarily the most sort of environmentally friendly items because, you know, they're using hard metals. You know. But there is an element of, you know, with the people we're working with in Europe, if we order 100 cases, we receive 100 cases and we can use 100 cases.
Right.
There's no like, oh, well, you know, they'll send us 500 and we can then only use 100. You know, the quality control is exceptional. And that means there's zero wastage.
Yeah. There's also an argument for sustainability just in goods that are meant to last. I mean, yes, the process might not be the cleanest process to make something, but a full metal movement that's serviceable, I mean, compare that to an Apple Watch or something, which literally you have to throw out in 2 years and is made with all sorts of unpleasant stuff. I mean, now they're using recycled aluminum, but the glass, the metals in the processor, all that stuff is still there, and you can't just pull it apart and recycle it. So, you know, buy something long-lasting, hand it down.
Well, this is it. And I mean, you know, when you first look at a Fierce watch, say our Brunswick, so it's a cushion case with a white hand-polished lacquer dial, blued hands. At first, you sort of look at it and go, oh, well, it's got, you know, this ETA movement in there and got this and that. And, you know, we get the ETA movements over from Switzerland. We then we service them, decorate them, change a few components before they go in our watches.
Okay. So you decorate themselves in the UK?
In the UK.
Okay.
And, but here's a bizarre fact. Our thermally blued hands that we make in-house cost 90% of that movement.
Okay. Wow.
So the movement is one of the least expensive parts of the watch. The case is multiple times the movement.
Wow.
Because the case has only one flat surface, the rear sapphire crystal. Every other surface has a different, at least two radiuses, one or two radiuses, you know, hand finishing. So that's the bit of the DNA from before that I like to have, you know, our slogan, which actually our best customer, he works in marketing. And he said over a beer one day, he said, oh, Nicholas, I've come up with a really good slogan. You should have this for your company. And you know, when you're thinking, you're a very good customer, so I have to sort of nod along and agree. And,
right.
And it was amazing. He said, it should be elegantly understated since 1846. And I thought, actually, yeah, that's what Fears did. It's what we do today. And what I'd like to see, you know, as and when there's a fifth managing director, I'd like to see them doing that as well. So we ended up trademarking the slogan.
Oh, wow.
I thought, you know, let's actually put some money behind this and say, no, we own this trademark. This is what Fears does. It's our thing. The elegant side is hopefully people would agree with the design. You know, it's classic, but contemporary. And the understated is, you know, it's elements to do with things like waterproofness, the way we build the watch. Screw down bezel gives it a far greater water resistance than we rate it at. You know, there's lots of things where, going back to the 1990s Mercedes-Benz, you know, it's that sort of, it's over-engineered. And for me, that's something that's important if you're making something that is still going to be worn and treasured in 40, 50, 60 years' time. You know, it's not only got to look good, it's got to be built well. And because of the hand-built element, it's got to be something that you treasure.
That's a very good slogan. And it feels natural, you know, like, I can see that beneath your name, you know, on an awning or on a bag or on a website, you know, if you So, okay, there's a lot to kind of think about there. So your watches then, as you've kind of alluded to, they're not inexpensive anymore. So the Brunswick is, it's around £3,000, is that correct?
So the Brunswick starts just under £3,000. Okay. With this 2-week trip to the US, I've very quickly learned the dollar pricing as well. So it's $3,100. So that's where the range starts. That's the starting point. And then we have different models going up from there.
And the first few models were quartz and they were less expensive, but those are sort of being phased out.
So we're now down to our final few quartz watches. We actually made a quartz watch to celebrate the 1,000th day since the company had restarted. Which was this summer. And I thought, actually, the thing is, the company's got this great, wonderful history. We're also a small business, you know, so it's actually important to acknowledge, like today, putting up an Instagram post with a cake with three candles going, actually, we have three years today, as well as 173 years old today. It's important because, you know, there's a lot of things, as you know, when you're running a business, you've got to, like, little decisions to make it keep going, keep lasting. And so I wanted to mark this 1,000th day with a watch, a watch that we were going to build in Britain, again, using German dial, finished case here. And we found this advert for a watch made in 1946, which was to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Fears. And it was called the Streamline. I thought, it's a rather very nice watch, very elegant, nice specification. So we sort of, we created a modern version of it, which we called the Redcliffe Streamline. And, you know, it's got a red central seconds hand. It's got a galvanized dial, a brush dial. It's got loads of little elements linked to the design before. But the thing and this is probably shows an element of my eccentricity, was we decided to price it the same as the original. So in 1946, the Streamline retailed for £11.02.6.
Okay.
And with 73 years inflation, that's £483 sterling.
Okay.
So on that watch, we limited it to 100 pieces. We make almost nothing on it. But it was a thing of going, actually, this is celebrating it, but it's also acknowledging and celebrating the final quartz watch that we're making.
Okay.
So it was sort of like, it was sort of a nice thing to sort of round off that. But all the other watches that will come in the future, the serial numbers continue from where the quartz ones finish.
All right.
So they don't get replaced. We don't do batch numbers. We do pure serial numbers. So there's only ever one watch with that serial number, so that we can track it when it comes back for servicing and things like that. That's important. We started with those watches, but now the future is all going to be mechanical.
And so you're switching, you know, from the quartz to mechanical, that raises the price point, but then you're also, you know, clearly doing a lot more of this kind of in-house processes, making your own hands, refinishing the movement, and you're doing that. So can you tell me, actually, I guess, a little bit about, like, what your factory, I mean, not that you have a factory, but your offices are like, that you're able to do this level of, you know, manufacturing yourself even.
Yes. So we were very lucky that we, very early on, well, it was actually on the day I restarted the company, a gentleman came up to me and said, oh, you should be doing a, you know, a hand-built mechanical watch made here in Britain. And I was like, yes, that would be lovely. But, you know, how, when, you know, and it was always in the plan that we'd make something like the Brunswick, but probably around year five, so 2 years from now. Anyway, over a lot of cups of tea with this gentleman, we worked out a way of doing a prototype. So we made the watch, and then it was a huge success. So we decided to start production making it. Now, the way it works is that workshop, it does a lot of after-sales servicing for a lot of the major brands. And then it builds for just two brands, myself and another British watch brand. So the great thing is we get to utilize the workshop's machinery, the tooling, the expertise, but, you know, there is, this is the bench And this is the watchmaker who works on the Fears watches. Mm-hmm. And it works well in that regards, because as a small business, I'm not having to set up a workshop from scratch, because that would be a lovely thing to do. But the cost is phenomenal. We're talking about, you know, you want to buy a new lathe, you know, that could easily go into high five, maybe six figures to get the right machines. Whereas with this way, we get to utilize those machines and the expertise, mm-hmm. but while still having our person who's making our watches. So we've got our own quality control, our own spare part, you know, doing it all from the workshop.
Okay. So you're saying it's your employee within the workshop?
Yeah. It means that don't get me wrong, one day it would be lovely that we've got a massive workshop back in Bristol with hundreds of watchmakers.
Oh, no, makes so much sense. I mean, it sounds also like an incredible opportunity. It really is. I imagine the opportunity also was born from somebody seeing, you know, a new UK brand and was excited to kind of help support that. You know,
it's interesting because with the workshop, we're also with our case and dial manufacturer. Mm. I was introduced to them by another British watch brand.
That's great.
Who said, I'm looking for someone new to work on with dials. And they said, I know this great company. I work with them. Let me make an introduction. Mm-hmm. These companies, they tend not to have websites. You know, there's no way to find them. And also, if you just sent them an email out of the blue, they'll probably just ignore you. Whereas mm-hmm. if you send an email saying, X from so-and-so has, you know, said I should speak to you, you know, then they go, we do mm-hmm. good business with them. So, you know, fly over, let's sit down and talk.
Yeah.
And it's very exciting to find these elements of the industry that those doors only open the longer you're going, the more you're doing. And if people like what you're doing and they think you're doing it with sincerity and it's not just trying to get, you know, make a quick buck.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, the way we make our watches, we make a few hundred watches a year. The dream would be in a few years' time, we're getting up to 500 and then maybe one day 1,000. But, you know, each watch takes so long to make, but to make it to a proper standard, it's not something that you can scale rapidly.
Yeah. Of course.
And I wouldn't want to, because a big thing I'm always thinking about is in the business plan, you're thinking about, what do we want to do in 5 years or 10 years? I'm also thinking about what do we do in 50 years? Mm-hmm. So the last two managing directors both worked for the company for 50 years. That puts me in my 80s.
Yeah.
And it seems strange to think of that, but it has a big influence on things like Fears has never done any sales. We never do any discounts. So the watch on my wrist, I bought that from the company full price.
Okay.
And it's just...
So even to that level, you're saying okay.
It's saying, you know what? There are so many hours going into this to make mm-hmm. this. Not only the hours to build it, but the hours of designing it. You know, I work usually 7 days a week. You know, I'm spending a lot of time designing and perfecting like minute details. Actually, this is what the watch is worth. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have a crazy margin, so we're not, you know, taking the piss. This is what's gone into it. But it's also saying we're wanting to create not only watches, but also a company that can last beyond 50 years. Mm-hmm. And that's actually more difficult so often nowadays, certainly in the sort of, I hate to use the phrase, but like the sort of entrepreneur world, mm-hmm. you know, everything is about grow fast, grow big, you know, doesn't matter who you trample on or how to get there. You've just got to get big and do it quickly. Let's look at what happens a few years after you've reached this supposed goal. Mm-hmm. Is the business still round, you know, in 10 years' time, 20 years' time?
Yeah, everything that grows that quick gets gobbled up by somebody else. So, you know, and you take a look at some of those companies, where they will be, you know, what will happen to that name, you know? And an example that pops to mind, although it might be a terrible example, we'll see, but like MVMT watches obviously famously sold, but they had a very different game. I mean, they were massively acceleration of growth.
Yes.
Will there be MVMT in 5 years or not? We'll see.
Yeah.
You know, it might just be a line on the Movado website.
And, you know, this is actually interesting where people say, you know, do you wish Fears had kept going? It hadn't closed mm-hmm. in 76. If it had kept going, Fears would have ended up merging with someone. Mm. And by the 90s, it would have been trademark owned. It probably wouldn't even be a name on a watch dial.
Right,
and by
right.
today, it would be an annoyance because someone else would own the trademark. And I'd have to be dealing with it. Whereas because the trademark elapsed, I was able to re-trademark, reincorporate, do everything because, and I'm lucky that no one else had decided to just buy the brand. Because just because it's my family's brand doesn't mean that I necessarily had any rights.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if someone else had already got there before me.
Yeah.
So in a way, because it closed and fully closed, it was a clean break.
Mm-hmm.
Those 40 years meant that it was enough time to kind of let everything settle to restart. But we did actually recently, I went to Bristol. Increasingly, I'm working with more and more companies based in Bristol. And I was there a few weeks ago and I had two very interesting experiences. One of them was someone had tracked down the final location that Fears was in
okay.
in 1976. And it's this beautiful Victorian wharf down by the harbour.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
It's now a bicycle shop and a very nice bar restaurant upstairs. So I immediately was like, right, well, in 2 years' time, in 2021, it's the 175th anniversary of Fears.
Mm-hmm.
We obviously have to do an event in the building that it closed in.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other thing was very strange. And I was amazed actually how much it affected me was someone had found in the Arnos Vale Cemetery in Bristol, under a foot of earth, the tombstone for Edwin Fear. And they tracked it down. Yeah. So they tracked it down with these Victorian hand-drawn plans.
Oh, wow.
And worked out where it was. And so they said, when you're next in Bristol, I've got something to show you. And so I went and saw it. And, you know, it just sort of a mound of earth, but like just the bit of stone, Edwin Fear, you know, watchmaker, Bristol Bridge. And it's that moment just thinking, wow, this is the man himself. You know, this is what consumes every waking hour of my life now is because of this gentleman. And so as part of the preparations for the 175th anniversary, the company is funding the restoration of his grave so that it doesn't just deteriorate to nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, you know, you try explaining that to my accountant and they're going, what on earth are you doing?
Like, that's long-term planning.
There's no ROI to this. And I go, no, but actually having a heritage isn't just by saying, oh, look, well, we've got this beautiful dial design or this beautiful case or this model name. You have to respect the whole heritage.
Yeah.
Especially when it's your family's name on the dial. Of course, like it's the whole thing together.
So, okay. Well, one quick question. I mean, so where is the Fears name now? Because your name isn't Fears. Just curious at where that kind of branched off to.
Yeah. So I come down on my grandmother's side.
Okay.
So that's why I don't have the Fear.
Okay. Yeah.
The Fear surname. And it's interestingly because when I got married, my double barrel surname came from my marriage. And it was interesting. People said, oh, well, why didn't you just do a deed poll? So in the UK, you can do something called a deed poll to change your name legally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, you could just do a deed poll and become Nicholas Fear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yes. But actually, no, that's quite inauthentic. Like, that's not my, you know, Fear isn't my surname, but it is, you know, it is my family name. So it was a thing of going, actually, no, even though it does sometimes cause a little confusion, but you know, in the first few issues of the brochure, we used to have a big family tree to show everyone, like, you know,
this is
the lineage and where it comes down.
You're going back that many generations, that must be a large tree, unless you've kind of trimmed it.
Trimmed it a little bit, yeah.
Trimmed it.
Because, I mean, that's the thing. When, you know, if you go back to when Fears was started, people go, oh, it's, you know, Victorian. It's like Queen Victoria was still in her 20s. She'd been on the throne for 9 years. Yeah. Like, it's literally...
It's very Victorian.
Yeah, it's like right at the beginning. Yeah, you know, the UK had only had standardized time for a year.
Wow.
So in Bristol, if you look at the main town hall, the clock has 2 minute hands. One of them shows Bristol time and one of them shows London time because they're 10 minutes apart. So GMT wasn't standardized. Yeah, the UK still had different time zones from city to city.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And Fears was founded a year after that.
Yeah.
But it's in a fascinating period because, of course, you've got people like Lange were founded in 1845, Cartier in 1847. You know, it's a very interesting period where a lot was happening. The world was changing. So I'm very grateful that Edwin decided to set up a workshop in Bristol.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. I feel like it's such a fascinating company because, like, well, you have like the world is now like this little treasure trove that, like, it seems like things keep coming to you to kind of further your story and build on this history that you're simultaneously discovering and communicating out, which is, you've got to be like the only brand around like that, which is really, you know, fascinating kind of. An amazing way to kind of build your company. I love, you know, finding the grave, finding the old place. Like, you're discovering the world around you, like your own history as you go and create this new brand, which has got to like constantly inform, you know? It just sounds very interesting to me. Like, as a
there was one of the reasons this year we set up the Fears Heritage Division. Mm-hmm. This is the division of the company where we service and restore old Fears watches.
Yeah.
And also we have a Fears Owners Club.
Okay.
It's free to join. The only requirement is that you own a Fears watch made since 1846. And it's amazing when we do a meetups together, because some people will have the latest Brunswick, which they took delivery of last week.
Mm-hmm.
Through to someone who goes, oh, well, this was my great-grandfather's watch, and he, you know, he wore it in the First World War, and, you know, and you get all these people together. Now, for me, what's fascinating is, and certainly with the service and restoration work, you know, we pretty much don't make any money on that.
Mm-hmm.
And we return the watches with an extract from the Fears archive.
Oh, wow.
But what we get from that is we get to see and examine the watches that the company had made before.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the original archive was destroyed in the Bristol Blitz.
Okay.
All the premises in Bristol took direct hits. So everything got blown up, and yet the business kept going.
Mm-hmm.
But then also in the 70s, when it closed, nowadays, if you were to close a business, there would always be something online. There would always be, you know, things don't just disappear. Back then you would have all this paperwork. And what do you do with it? Well, the business is clearly never going to be restarted. So I think there was probably a big bonfire, you know, burning the old records. So for us, it's really, this is a really nice way of actually discovering, you know, more about the designs, you know, how things were made. And I mean, we're talking about, like, when I first found out about Fears from my mother, you know, I knew, well, this is a podcast, so this doesn't really show well, but I probably knew a couple of inches worth of knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, by the time I launched, I knew maybe about a foot.
Yeah.
Today, I know sort of yards and yards and yards.
Yeah.
And that's because people keep coming forward saying, oh, did you know this? You know, we were in contact with an old chap who used to be a watchmaker for Fears.
Oh, wow.
So he's in his, I think, his 80s.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating talking to him because he's got all these wonderful little stories about what it was like to work for the company before. And, you know, for me, that knowledge, I mean, I'm lucky that 40 years wasn't 50 years. Because if the company had closed in 66, more of that information would have been lost. Yeah, we're just at the point where people remember buying a watch in the 40s from Fears, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's trying to get that information and just let it. And also, when you receive it, just let it settle. You don't need to do anything with it. You just let it settle, build in the archive.
We're just filling in all these gaps. And
exactly. It's like a giant jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that's what it just, it feels like you're, this discovery process you're going through is got to be, I mean, a lot of the fun of it, but then helps inform every decision you make moving forward as you're sticking to that heritage. And it's just, it's an extremely unique experience, it sounds like, or at least a method of kind of building a brand, especially just compared to a lot of the young brands that we talk to who don't have any heritage to build off beyond the kind of collective heritage of watches and watchmaking and what vintage, you know, watches look like. But they're just starting anew. So there is no story to come to them about a watchmaker kind of thing.
There's so much about vintage watches. I love watches. You know, when I was very, I now look back on it and think, my goodness, I sold my watch collection. You know, I had an Amiga Seamaster Great White, which I spent 2 years between the ages of 16 and 18 years old doing two Saturday jobs, a Sunday job in amongst my studies to save up to buy this watch brand new. Back in 2005, watches weren't cool. They weren't like, you know, I was a weird teenager who wanted to buy an expensive Swiss watch. But then when I was at Rolex, I bought a couple of Rolexes, one of which was my Grail watch. I was lucky enough to buy my Grail watch, which was a white gold day date.
Oh, wow.
With a white dial, smooth bezel, president bracelet. I wore that watch every day for 2 years. It was pride and joy. But when you're setting up the business, very quickly, those things are like, right, well, this has got, this has got a monetary value.
For a greater good, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's interesting when you look at vintage watches, because people always go on, like, it's about the design. And yes, it is about the design, the proportions, you know, they were made as very elegant watches. I mean, there's also a big thing with them is, why do we like that watch? Well, because we know it had all that history. Mm-hmm. It was someone's one watch. They wore it on their wedding day, the promotion at work, birth of a child. You know, it's the one watch they've done for everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, look, I run a watch company, so I shouldn't be advocating one watch purchase, you know. But at the same time, it is, it sounds weird. It's sort of the watches I make today, yes, they have little elements from the archive, from the vintage watches. The biggest thing I'm trying to put into them is that if this was your one watch, it's enough of an item that you would treasure.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, so we've got quite a few owners who have big watch collections, you know, very, very nice watches in those collections, you know, Vacherons, Langers, Pateks. And, but they keep saying they like wearing their Fears. Mm-hmm. The Fears is what ends up being their daily watch. It's the one they just put on. They like it. And it's nice because it's of a build quality that for someone who is discerning enough that they're really happy with it. But it's also not, you know, a $20,000 watch. Yeah. So they can wear it out and use it and enjoy it. And I think it's those sort of relationships with the, that's why watches are special. Mm-hmm. You know, the watch I'm wearing today, I've worn for 2 years now.
Yeah.
You know, I've worn it on trips. I've worn it on this trip for every day of the last 2 weeks. You know, you can't replace that.
Totally.
I'm an old romantic, so, you know.
No, well, it goes back to the trains, I feel like. I, you know, I was thinking about that earlier. I feel like in the U.S. we might have a different relationship. At least as a New Yorker, I think of the subways. That's my train. And that's, I don't have much of a romantic relationship with the subway. But like that classic idea of like a steam locomotive kind of a thing, yes, going across the country and, you know, or between countries. Like there is a nostalgia to that, you know, that you can kind of latch on to or believe in, you know. And certainly with watchmaking, too. So I guess, you know, what is the plan moving forward?
So, well, as I said earlier, today is the third anniversary. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating looking at the comments on Instagram, you know, from around the world, from people. And the love and support is, I find it very humbling because people really seem to like what the company's doing. But it's also people going like, well, you know, here's the next 3 years, you know, what's coming next? And, you know, so we're building towards things like the 175th anniversary. Mm-hmm. You have to plan a long way in advance when you're developing watches. You know, we're still a self-financed business, so we don't have the money to develop, you know, five models at one time. We just can't do that. But also, I design each watch myself. I don't want to have to compartmentalize my brain and creative space to go, right, I've got to work on this one today, this watch tomorrow, this one. No, I do one at a time. We have a new watch coming out in mid-November, which has been over a year in development. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be quite a significant watch because it's on a sort of different level in terms of sort of details and, you know, little elements that when it's launched, and we've been showing it to people in the States, it's really nice to see people going like, wow, this is something different, you know.
Okay.
So yeah, I think going forward, it's going to be, you know, one or two watches a year, slowly growing the range. We have two families of watches, Redcliffe and Brunswick. Mm-hmm. Redcliffe is named after Redcliffe Street, where Edwin started the business. And Brunswick is named after Brunswick Square in Bristol, which is where the export side of the business was established.
Okay.
So the watch doesn't say 1846 anywhere on it. To me, that's a bit obvious. It's the easy thing to do, just stick Fears 1846. What I'd rather do is subtly reference it, but importantly, two watch families. Every watch we make fits into those two families rather than having, you know, 12 or 15 different families. I'd rather keep it really tight so that, and also we batch make watches, but the watches are constant. You know, they're not limited editions. They're not oh, well, the White Dial Brunswick will make 100 and that's it. No, it's, you know, yesterday we celebrated 2 years of production. Mm-hmm. That watch is going to stay in the brochure indefinitely.
Yeah.
You know, for me, that's very important. It's, and I guess this partly comes from having worked at Rolex.
Yeah. They're kind of the kings of that, aren't they?
Yeah. You know, you go to them and you say, you want a dive watch? They go, what color do you want? Black or green?
Yeah.
That's it. You know, there aren't loads of options,
but
everything is done really carefully to make it just right. Yeah. And I kind of, for me, that is, I really appreciate that.
It's interesting. You definitely see those two ways of doing things. And I think a lot of people are leaning towards the limited edition, constant new drop sort of thing, kind of build in preciousness on something that is a little more in the moment, whereas you're looking down the road a lot longer. So,
you know, the precious element is saying, you know, does your Brunswick have a 2-digit serial number? Because we're, you know, we're now building the watches in the 3 digits, you know. And I know at a recent Fears Owners Club meetup, someone had a 1-digit serial number Brunswick. And they were like a mini celebrity of the evening.
People were
like, wow, you've got one of the very first watches ever made. And, you know, you compare that to modern, the watch, you know, in the case today, it's, they look the same. But it's that's what makes it precious. Not the fact that, oh, we've only made 100, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's also important that, you know, the watches have that DNA running through them. You know, I know up on the wall, you've got from my good friend Chase at Oak and Oscar. I'm a huge fan of that brand. Mm-hmm. And what I loved and I saw at Windup was seeing, you know, the first watch they made, then the second. Yeah. And you look at the latest watch, which I absolutely love, and you can see that DNA. You can see how it sort of evolved. And to me, that's more valuable than having, you know, 20 model lineup.
Yeah.
I'd rather see someone go, no, we're going to really invest on getting this just right. Maybe a few dial options and that's it. You know, choice is good, but at the same time, there was that old Henry Ford saying, you know, if he had asked his customers what they wanted, faster horses.
Faster horses, yeah. I love that saying.
I think it's true.
Yeah, no, certainly, certainly. That's what, you know, my dad comes from a marketing, advertising background, and he talks about like focus groups a lot. And I'm just like, I think they're the worst idea ever. And I think we had a kind of several decades of things that were made via focus group, and you kind of lost the artistry. And
I mean, look, when I'm designing a watch, fundamentally, I've got to love it, right? You know, and there's a reason why our watches are slightly on the smaller sides. I have absolutely tiny little wrists, you know, so you're not going to start seeing like 45 millimeter case watches because that's just not the aesthetic or what I want to make. Mm-hmm. There is also then a flip side where actually you do need to make sure that you're not just making your dream watch. You know, it's finding that balance. And that's why I make all the final decisions on things, but I haven't what I call my brain's trust. And that's three people, one of who is my husband. Mm-hmm. He's a maths professor. So nothing to do with the watch industry or even the company, but he's a good, honest person to give an opinion on. Someone else who runs another British watch company.
Okay.
And then someone who works for a luxury brand. Mm-hmm. And those three, I will share early designs with. I will share, you know, thoughts. Should I be doing this? Could I do this? And, you know, it's really good to get three people's opinions who basically will tell me if they think I'm being an idiot or am I being too, you know, sort of away with the fairies or, you know, go, actually, that's really good. That's really what Fears should be doing.
Yeah.
Yes, I would love to say we could ask everyone out there, like, what should we be doing next? Or, you know, this dial or that dial. But no, look, at the end of the day, I would rather make a product you love or hate. I don't know if it translates here. In the UK, we have a saying, whether something's a Marmite. So the Marmite spread is famously you either love it or you hate it. Yeah, no one likes it, right? Yeah. Did you like it or?
It was a long time ago. I was like 10 or something. So my palate was not, but no, I did not like it at that point. Yeah. No.
But you know, I would rather, when I open my case of watches, when I show people what Fears makes, I'd rather they go, I love this. Or they go, it's nice. It's not for me.
Yeah.
I don't want someone to go, oh, I like it. It's a pretty watch.
Right.
I want to see the passion, you know, and if you want to, you know, at the end of the day, we don't make our watches in a quantity or the method of production doesn't allow us to be making tens of thousands of watches a year. Mm-hmm. So we're not making watches for everyone out there.
Yeah.
We're making it for the people who really want it.
Yeah.
And
it's
absolutely fine if that's not for you, but you know,
of course.
But it's true what you say about the focus groups, you know, it can be death by focus group.
Yeah. And also just, I mean, you know, I'm sure you're aware of the current trends and, you know, you're taking those into consideration when you're designing to some extent. You don't want to make something that is so completely against what people are interested in that it would never in a million years find that, even that those few people that do really want it. But trends can also kill a brand. I mean, I've seen a lot of smaller brands come up and be so focused on what's happening right now, which is, you know, it's narrow and they come in these kind of cycles of a couple of years that like, what are they going to do? Is their brand so attached to the single concept that when, and I'll just, you know, put it out there, but like vintage dive watches are so on trend right now that if that's the only thing you can do or know how to do, I mean, you might get left behind at some point.
Well, I mean, I've been at collector events in London where people have said, oh, you know, it's always that moment when someone says, you know what you should be doing.
Yeah.
You smile and go, yes, absolutely. Tell me what I should be doing. Yeah. And they'll go, you should be making a lovely, you know, 38, 39 millimeter dive watch, you know, da, da, da. That's fine. One, that wasn't what Fears used to do.
Yeah.
Two, I can't swim. So I personally do have no interest in making a dive watch.
Yeah.
But also, three, it is right with the trend thing. It's saying, yeah, that's great. But you know what? And I will always happily say this. If someone comes to me and says, oh, I really want a dive watch. Well, I can point to several of my British compatriots who make incredibly good dive watches. Why do I need to be playing in that field? You know, I know what Fears does and what we do well. And that's where we should be focused. And I mean, when it comes to trends and things, So at heart, I'm a watch geek. Since I was, you know, about 12, 13 years old, I've always loved watches. At a time before really the internet even had, you know, there weren't blogs. You know, people had the odd forum post. There was almost no magazines published about watches. And if they were, they were always sort of hidden up on the top shelf with pornography. You know, it was kind of hidden away as one of these weird things. But, you know, every day I read a couple of watch reviews for brands, you know, all kinds of range of brands, just because it's not only interesting to me, but it's also interesting just to see what everyone is doing.
Yeah.
You know, I love nothing more than the first day of SIHH because I legitimately can spend an afternoon basically sat in my office in my comfy chair with a big pot of tea, going through all the releases and just looking at them.
Yeah.
And then a few days later, I'll fly out there myself and, you know, spend a day walking around, often with other British watch brand owners.
Yeah.
You know, we'll walk around together because that's the fascinating thing. We'll be walking around getting each other's opinions on it. And what do you think of this? And, you know, and it's just, I think that's the thing. It's if you like watches, you're always going to be interested in it, but it is following trends. I mean, you know, I mean,
you have to some extent, but you also have to make your own way, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like we're going a little long, but you talk a little, you know, walking around the other British watchmakers. And I feel like, you know, in the last few years, the British watchmaking scene has really kind of hit a stride. You know, well, I guess it once did a long time ago, but this kind of new generation. I don't know. Could you just speak a little bit to like what it's like to be a British watchmaker right now and like where you see yourself within the other brands? And
well, I think what's very nice is nearly all of the British watch brands talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And when I say talk to each other, it's not just like, oh, you've launched a new watch, I'll send you a compliment, you know. It's a case of actually sitting down and talking to them. So, you know, you mentioned you're wearing the Farah. You know, I know the guys from Farah. You know, at Wind Up, it was lovely to kind of, you know, get chatting to them away from the stand for a few minutes, you know, showing them what I'm about to be launching, you know, getting their feedback on things. I mentioned earlier people like Vertex Watches. Don, who restarted his family's watch company. The number of people who think we should be enemies because we've both got British watch companies in our family history that relaunched. He relaunched 6 months after Fears. Every month we have lunch together.
Yeah.
And we sit down and we just, you know, chat about all kinds of, you know, things about it.
And the style of watch is incredibly different, but it seems like the approach to the business is not entirely different.
That's it. I think there's no cookie cutter thing of this is how a British watch brand is. People are doing all kinds of things differently. Next month, my husband and I are spending a weekend over in the Isle of Man. We're going to go and visit Roger Smith. And when he's over in London, we try and meet up for a drink. And, you know, it's, you've got people like him at one end of the scale, and then you've got people at the other end of the scale who maybe are having the watches made out in Hong Kong. But at the end of the day, look, if you're passionate about what you're doing and you have a real strong belief that you are creating what you believe is like the perfect watch and it's a reflection of who you are, not a reflection of what you will think will sell because it's trendy at the moment, hey, we're going to get on. And actually, we do find that in the British watch space is, we've mentioned earlier, like we are doing different things. Yes, there is, of course, a bit of overlap here or there. But actually, there is also a thing where I would rather someone was interested in buying a British watch over going and buying, say, a Swiss watch or a German watch.
Right.
You know, look, if you go to Germany, they've got things like, you know, the Glashütte, you know, in Saxony. Like they've got that name that means that everyone from Nonos to Lange has got that strong bond and identity and the made in Germany line. Switzerland obviously has Swiss made and, you know, they've got their federation joining them together. And in Britain, we don't have that.
Yeah.
So it's important that we are working together and either by supporting each other by saying, oh, look, you need a dial manufacturer, here's a recommendation, or, you know, you need a box packaging manufacturer, let me recommend here.
Yeah.
But it is that thing of kind of saying we are kind of together, got our own sort of aesthetic, our own design. I mean, I read somewhere that, I don't know whether everyone would agree with me on this, but they said the British design sensibility is graceful yet purposeful design. So the idea is that things are designed for purpose, but they have a little quirk, a little extra bit to the design that makes it graceful. And I thought that's actually quite a nice way of doing it, that actually when you look at the watches coming out of Britain today, most of them would have that, you know, whether they're a field watch or a dive watch or a cushion case manual wind watch like my own, they've all got their purpose, but they have got something there. mm-hmm. design. And I'm not trying to say, oh, look, British design is far better than everyone else's mm-hmm. design. I'm just saying that it is different. You know, it's a reflection of who we are. Just as I think, you know, when you look at American watches, mm-hmm. there is a common trait amongst them. Yeah, the same with German ones, mm-hmm. you know. I think it's important that you have as an industry a sort of identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. And, you know, I've grown to really appreciate the British watches. I mean, several of these brands are brands I've known for a long time. I mean, Christopher Ward in particular, they're one of the first brands to ever lend us a watch for review. And seeing how they've grown, I think, has been really enjoyable for me on just a personal level, because I think their watches have just gotten to this great high point right now. But they also have a conservativeness to them. And I think it kind of goes to what you're saying, though. They're not... You know, they have a couple pieces that are a little out there in their own way. They still feel very Christopher Ward to me, but I feel like they have like a Britishness to their design. It's a, they go, but they don't go too far. It's sort of like a restrained, but I think graceful is kind of a nice way of putting it. But I like that as a whole. I think the British watches are becoming more, they're not similar, but I guess like you can kind of feel that there's an aesthetic forming sort of together apart. I'm having a hard time kind of articulating it, but I'll say this. I know when a watch is Swiss, and I know when somebody wants their watch to look like a Swiss-made watch.
Yes.
To me, it is very little. It's very boring to see a watch that wants to look like a Swiss-made watch that's not from Switzerland.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I think the British watches are just getting away from that, and a lot of the American brands are also getting away from that, you know. It's good to see. There's, like... Because I like to shop globally. I'm not attached to any, you know, I'm regional. I like to see these things kind of grow within their region and kind of ferment apart from each other and then propose something interesting. So
it's very similar to the automotive industry. You know, spending 2 weeks in the States, you know, I've been in New York, I've been in Nashville, Chicago, San Francisco. And, you know, in the UK, we might see the odd Cadillac, which someone's imported, but we just don't see American cars. Whereas here, you know, you're walking around and a lot of the cars are American. Mm-hmm. And yes, they're obviously different brands, they look different, but they do have a certain degree, you know, there's more chrome on the cars, you know, they have bigger grills.
Yeah.
They, you know, if it's a SUV, it's boxier, it's squarer. Yeah, yeah. Whereas you see the Range Rovers, you know, mm-hmm. on the streets outside, they're more curved, they're more British. It's the same, you know, you look at German sedans, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's a BMW, an Audi, a Mercedes, you know, they look different, but they have a certain look and a certain presence. And I think watches are beginning, it's important that they do reflect that a bit.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you have to forcefully design it in, but I think it's by saying, as you correctly put it, don't try and emulate something someone else is doing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's just not the right way. It's got to be true to like your roots and, you know, the subtleties of how you've learned to design something.
Certainly. Well, Nick, excellent. Nicholas, is there anything else you'd like to add before we sign off today?
No, I mean, I have said the last 2 weeks touring the States has mm-hmm. been incredible. You know, for a while, the United States has been the sort of number one place of Fears owners. Okay, and yet I've never done any marketing. I'd never visited here. So it's been so nice to go around and meet different watch collecting groups, meet different people. And it's lovely to see how liken we have in England and in Scotland and places, a group of very passionate people mm-hmm. who will appreciate everything from a watch costing $100 to $100,000. And I think it's, you know, that's such a good thing to see. And certainly it's going to be the first of several trips I'm going to make over here. Okay. Yeah, I'm already planning the next visit for the spring. So
perfect. Perfect. All right. Well, thanks again for coming.
Thank you for having me.
And your website is?
It's very simple. Fearswatches.com. And on social media, Fears Watches.
All right, excellent. So everyone go check them out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Worn & Wound Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Looking for a new watch? A strap? Don't forget to visit the Wind Up Watch Shop. And of course, head to wornandwound.com daily for news and reviews of great wristwatches. Music tracks Nowhereland and Inspired are by Kevin MacLeod and are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0.